Now, lying directly between it, at the floor of the third pouch, is another structure which forms, and this is the thymus. Here it is here. It's endodermal in origin from the floor of that third pouch. And the thymus has an important role in maturation of thymocytes. It also has a role in the embryo as a site for hematopoietic cells during development. So before we have bone marrow, they can reside there. And we also have identified that the thymus can also have abnormalities associated with it because of its developmental location between the two parathyroids. Occasionally you can get parathyroid cells displaced into the thymus. So you can have accessory parathyroid cells located within the thymus, and led to a lot of confusion about the origins of parathyroid hormone. We also get later in development neural crest mesenchyme contributing to it, and there's an interaction between that endodermal epithelium and the neural crest cells that populate the region of the thymus. So let's drop down out of the neck. Oh, doing pretty well. And drop down to the pancreas. So we've left the pharyngeal arch structures, and we're going to now look at the development of the pancreas. And in the pancreas, you have two key functions, an exocrine function, the secretion of alpha amylase and digestion, which occurs functionally significantly after birth. So the exocrine development and differentiation can occur during the fetal period, but its actual physiological functions postnatally. In contrast, the endocrine function by the pancreatic islets, or the islets of Langerhans, occurs prenatally. And so they begin as the ends of the endoderm coming out of the gut, the surrounding mesenchyme, and they'll be budding off the ends of that endoderm. So our pancreatic islets form initially as endodermal buds that are separated from the surface epithelium. Oh, sorry, the surface, surface epithelium, which is endodermal. And the epithelium itself will remain as part of the exocrine duct system of the pancreas. But the buds which come off will be separated from that and will form the beginnings of the islets. So you remember when we talked about GIT, there are two buds that form in the pancreas, an anterior and posterior. The same process is going on in both of these buds in terms of early islet formation. And when the two fuse together, we've got the appearance of the islets. Now, the islets have four different endocrine cells that form within them, and there are different cells that secrete each one of those hormones. Alpha being the glucagon-secreting cells, beta the insulin, delta the somatostatin, and the F cells, the pancreatic polypeptide. Of course, the one you've heard most about are glucagon and insulin in terms of regulation of blood sugar levels. And obviously, during growth, you want to maintain lots of energy available for the growth of the fetus. All of these have different locations within the islet itself. And it's important to you clinically because this is the structure which is so much affected by diabetes. It's also a structure which in the fetus can be impacted upon by maternal conditions of abnormalities in endocrine function. So maternal diabetes, abnormal maternal blood sugar levels can impact upon the development of the islets themselves. So in terms of the functioning of these islets, between week 7 to 20, so once again, toward the end of the embryonic period, into the second trimester, we can identify the secretion of pancreatic hormones. We see a small amount of maternal insulin within the fetus as well. But by week 10, we can identify glucagon, somatostatin, all of the different hormones from the different cells. And by week 15, there are detectable amounts of glucagon in the fetal plasma. So whether it's manufacturing it and whether you can detect it are two different things, of course. So you can detect manufacture earlier on than you can measure the levels in circulation. So the pancreas and the islets within the fetus, important for fetal growth. And the regulation of blood sugar levels is independent relatively, from that of the maternal levels. And remember, during pregnancy, the mother's metabolism becomes resistant to insulin, so she's maintaining higher blood sugar levels than she would in a non-pregnant state to support fetal growth. So in terms of what we can see, it's the usual, you know, dark purple spots on a page. Here is the week 8 in development. This is the region of the pancreatic duct, the duodenum here. Go away. And the pancreas is forming in this region here. It's nestling between the stomach and the duodenum. So the stomach's coming out, going into the duodenum, and right here is our developing pancreas. And it appears to be a series of little tubular structures which are branching out, and the tips of these tubes will bud off to form our islets. Remember that they only contribute about 1% of the total mass of the pancreas. So most of the pancreas by volume is that exocrine role which occurs postnatally. So as we drop down just above the kidneys, the suprarenals or the adrenal glands, which we talked about the histology of in terms of the cortex and medulla, and I'll remind you again that each of these has a different embryonic origin. So when we look at the development of the adrenal gland, the hormones that we can certainly measure secretion of these during the fetal period, but the cortex originates as mesothelium, and mesothelium is the lining of the perineal cavity region. So we can see the epithelium that lines that cavity is described as the mesothelium, and the cells within that epithelium will contribute the cortex. Not the adult cortex, a fetal cortex. So during the fetal period, the adrenal gland is a specialised fetal cortex that is different from the adult cortex. So you form a whole fetal cortex which has an important role for fetal growth and development, and replace it with an adult line later on in late fetal and postnatal development. So I made a very simple cartoon that I thought would be useful to try and explain what's going on. Somewhere here. Keep closing those windows. So, at an early stage in the embryo, we've got a neural tube in the midline shown in blue. We've got neural crest cells which arise at the dorsal side of the neural tube. We've got the gut tube shown in green, so it's a section through the embryo, notochord in black, dorsal aorta in red. And we've got a population of cells migrating out of that mesothelium layer that will contribute the fetal cortex of the adrenal gland. Now, the adrenal medullary cells are nowhere near the adrenal gland at this stage. They're right around the back. They're neural crest cells. The medulla is neural crest in origin. So we see a migration of neural crest cells down. They migrate down adjacent to the neural tube, between the somites and over the somites, but it's the ones that migrate down between the somites in front of the neural tube that form initially the population of cells which lies just in front of the spinal cord, and this is the sympathetic ganglia, the sympathetic chain. So some of the neural crest cells say, we've gone far enough, this is as far as we're walking today, and they stay there and they form the sympathetic chain. A subpopulation of these cells continue to migrate ventrally, and as they migrate ventrally, they accumulate adjacent to our cortical region just there. So this is the neural crest origin of the adrenal medulla and the cortex coming from the mesothelium. See that it lies just next to the dorsal aorta here. And so we have a branch from the dorsal aorta coming out, vascularising this region, and therefore leading to the connection between the developing adrenal gland and the central vascular system. Now, the adult cortex will differentiate from the periphery of the fetal cortex and occurs in stages. So in the late fetal period, we begin to see the appearance of the adult cortical zones. At birth, we have two of the zones present, the zona glomerulosa and the zona fasciculata. That third cortical zone, the reticularis, only can be observed postnatally at 3 years of age. So the adrenal gland has a long period of differentiation, beginning in the third trimester when the adult cortex begins to form, and then continuing postnatally through to 3 years of age. On the other hand, the adrenal medulla does not get replaced. The neurocrest cells that make up the adrenaline and noradrenaline secreting cells, the equivalent of postganglionic neurons, remains as they always are. So you just replace the cortex around it. The final endocrine system that I'll mention today are the gonads. And we've got two separate axes depending upon whether you're male or female and the types of feedback mechanisms that are occurring in terms of endocrine loops. So we've got luteinizing and follicle stimulating hormone being the same in both of these cycles, both of them acting on the gonads, but in this case leading to a testosterone, or the precursors for testosterone being synthesized, and in the female, estrogen and progesterone. The male and female gonad have quite different paths of differentiation and development. In BGDB, we'll be doing genital development, so I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about how the gonads actually form in a separate part of your practical class and lecture. But I'll mention it here in terms of its origins. It's got a mesodermal origin, which forms mesothelium. Once again, the same mesothelium we're describing for the adrenal glands directly above it. We've got a gonadal ridge, which is formed from the mesonephric duct region and the interaction with it with the primordial germ cells. The primordial germ cells populate the regions of where the testes and ovary are going to form. Their origin lay outside of the embryo, right at the junction between the hind gut and the yolk sac. So they sit there in early development, waiting for the genital ridge to form, and then when the genital ridge forms, our primordial germ cells migrate into the gonadal ridges and populate them. So we've got quite a different embryonic origins for the cells, the functional cells of the gonads, and the hormone-secreting cells, which will be the follicular cells or the interstitial cells for the testes. So when I talk about the differences between the two, it's quite significant even prenatally. In the testes, about 8 weeks, we can see the interstitial cells of the cells of Leydig secreting testosterone and androsterone. And both of these are important because if these are not secreted at this point in the end of embryonic period, then we won't have differentiation of the internal and external genital tracts in the male. So this is critical endocrine function for the male systems during this period of development. So we can see also the support cells, known as the sustentacular cells or the Sertoli cells, same thing, produce AMH, which is anti-Müllerian hormone, which is inhibiting the paramesonephric duct's development, which is the female genital tract. So this has an important hormonal role in inhibition of development of the female system. If you measure the levels of both AMH, and it's got a range of other names which you'll see in the literature, I've put all of them there, they're all the same thing. Just remember that they're involved in inhibition of the paramesonephric duct or Müllerian duct. If you look at the levels in humans during prenatal and postnatal development, firstly of AMH, in the late embryo, we see a huge increase in secretion, and this leads to regression of the paramesonephric duct system. And once again, I'm coming back and talking about this in genital development, so if I'm going a bit fast today, it's because we're going to hear it again. This level of AMH remains high right to birth and through all of childhood period. So this hormone actually may have a role in the onset of puberty as well, because as we begin to decline AMH levels, we get the onset of puberty occurring postnatally. In contrast, if you look at the levels of testosterone, it, with the late egg cell differentiation, elevates during the late embryonic period and remains high through fetal development when you're forming the internal male and external male genital tract, and it supports its differentiation. At birth, we get testosterone dropping significantly and remaining low through childhood. So the male sex hormone remains very low through all of childhood development. And we only see an elevation again once AMH begins to drop. We see a surge in testosterone driving the puberty in males, the secondary sex characteristic development. So that's the testes. In the ovary, it's a different story altogether, because if you remember in the ovary, and here's a newborn infant's ovary, where are all the follicle cells? Where are all the hormone secreting cells? Well, they're there. They're around in a single layer of cells around these primordial oocytes, primordial germ cells in the ovary, but we're not getting follicular development. And so the female hormones are very low through childhood because the cells that manufacture them are not differentiating to form the follicles. So at the onset of puberty, we see a proliferation of these primordial cells, a recommencement of meiosis, and the differentiation of the fecal cells and the granulosa cells, and the surges then in estrogen and progesterone, and the initiation of the menstrual cycle. But just not here. Different differentiation of the gonad, and we'll talk about the difference between male and female gonad differentiation in genital development, so we'll cover that there. There's one more endocrine organ that we can't drop down to, and that's because it's not inside the embryo at all, or fetus, and it's the placenta. Placenta's got lots of roles in development. And the first one you saw was in the very early placentation. The chorionic gonadotrophin that it secretes supports the corpus luteum back in the ovary, which supports the pregnancy. So that's its first hormonal role very early on. It secretes HCG, which goes back and supports the corpus luteum and maintains the functional layer, and also the secretions of the corpus luteum support the decidualisation of the maternal uterine layer. So this decidualisation process occurs every second half of a menstrual cycle during that proliferation and secretion events, but it's maintained by the corpus luteum. We also see later on in development that the placenta actually takes over that role of supporting the functional layer of the uterine lining. So the corpus luteum only in the initial phases of the pregnancy, and its role is taken over by the placenta later on. So the placenta is the key maintainer of the pregnancy during the fetal period. It also synthesises a range of other hormones, chorionic somatotrophin. All of them have a range of different names. They're all preceded by human, and they all have human chorionic because they come from the placenta. And then the last term refers to the similar hormonal role that the other endocrine glands have. So this is the similar to the placental lactogen role in that it stimulates maternal mammary development during the pregnancy. Chorionic thyrotrophin, a stimulator of thyroid hormone secretion. We've even got an chorionic ACTH secretion from the placenta. Progesterones and estrogens made by the placenta, as I said, supporting the pregnancy later on. And then a range of other hormones that are involved in the birthing process. So relaxin, which alters the strength of the joints in the pubic symphysis, so it becomes more flexible. So lots of hormones. We see a surge of HCG up to 20 weeks, and then it plateaus. And then the synthesis of these steroidal hormones. In particular, it's able to transform testosterone as well from the inactive form to the active form. So they're the endocrine glands, all of them within you except for the placenta, which you discard at birth. And it has important roles in the differentiation of the hormonal system within the fetus. There are other endocrine tissues, but I'm not going to describe them as part of the ductal system today. This has come from more recent research over the last 20 years or so, which has identified that many tissues secrete hormones: the heart, the kidney, the endocrine system, and adipose tissue. And all of these hormones have important roles in regulating GIT function, kidney function, adiposity, growth. You don't need to know that for today's class. So this would be listed in my practical class as additional information. And it's really the ductless glands that I expect you to know in detail. I've included them here today so that you can think about what the other endocrine systems are that are forming within the fetus. I'd like to spend my last couple of minutes on Earth, in this lecture. Not here, I wouldn't spend it here. Or maybe I would, who knows. You don't get to pick. Talking about the abnormalities of various endocrine glands as they form. You can see, because of the dual origins, we sometimes have abnormalities in the structure. You can see that's because some of the cells need to migrate from an embryonic location to their adult location. We can have abnormalities in migration. But we can also have abnormalities in the function of the endocrine cells as well. And I've listed some of the types of abnormalities we see for each one of these glands. Once again, I wouldn't expect you to know them in detail, but I do think it fits into the current VGD scenarios. In the pineal gland, there are a range of tumours which can form within the pineal. Some of them are associated with abnormal childhood growth and puberty development. We can see hyperplasia as well of the gland, which can damage the eye or the retina as well in the pineal gland. The pituitary has a huge range of abnormalities which can impact upon fetal growth and development, as well as impacting upon diseases postnatally. And you'll be covering these in scenarios, but I'll remind you about Cushing's disease, growth hormones effects. So the failure of growth postnatally is a lack of that growth hormone, leading to that wonderful character in Game of Thrones, best character in the series. And so you don't get normal postnatal growth either. And there are a range of tumours that we're going to see associated with the pituitary as well, described as adenomas. Some of these are not terribly aggressive, but do affect expression of the hormones. With the thyroid, I have mentioned already one of the abnormalities, or actually it's called a variation in anatomy, in that you get a third lobe forming on the anterior surface. Many people in the population, 1 in 1,000, have it. I've picked the wrong statistic. 50% of people have this additional lobe where the isthmus should be, joining the two lobes on the anterior region, and this is the pyramidal lobe. Other than the overall mass of the thyroid, it doesn't seem to have major functional abnormalities, but it is a variation in the population. We have congenital hyperthyroidism, 1 in 3,000 births, and this lack of thyroid development means a lack of neurological development. So they're trickle-on events. If you don't have a proper endocrine system, then you don't have full development of the other systems. Not going to mention iodine deficiency again. With parathyroid, there's variability once again. Usually you get 4 parathyroids, but you can either have 3 to 6 forming. So there's a big variability in the total number of parathyroid glands that form. And I've also mentioned that you can get displaced parathyroid cells associated with the thymus as well. Pancreas you'll cover elsewhere. This relates to abnormal development of the islets and anything that impacts upon the islet function. And the adrenal glands, the major one you'll be talking about in scenario groups, would be congenital adrenal hyperplasia, which relates to the function of the cells, the lack of an enzyme for conversion of the functional cells. Finally, I need to mention that in addition to the genetic and developmental abnormalities, we know that within the environment there are a range of endocrine disruptors. And many of these fall into three classes. Those that mimic the normal hormone in development, so DES in plastic or has a potent estrogen role and can impact upon development. We have those which block a hormone's function, and an example of this would be finasteride. It's the thing that male pattern baldness they treat with, and a fungicide here. Both of these can impact upon hormone by blocking its binding to its receptor. And then we have a third class of endocrine disruptors, those that interfere with the hormone, so hormone transport or elimination, and PCBs being an example of that. So I got to the bottom, finished my lecture. Thanks very much for your attention today.